I'm writing this letter.
Hi, I'm Alex Beam. I'm a living arts columnist for the Boston Globe, and this is my hate mail podcast. I think we have some nice astringent commentary here provided by men and women who aren't exactly into what I do for a living. We've invited Dave Beard, who runs our digital operations here at the Boston Globe, to read all the letters we've received from men who hate me. And we've invited Meredith Goldstein, who helps write the sidekick section of the Boston Globe. Meredith will be reading all the nasty letters from women, and our producer is Ann Silvio. I have friends who've listened to some of these hate mail podcasts, and one recurring theme is, why am I not slamming the people who are actually slamming me? I mean, just in the next few minutes, you'll hear some fairly tough stuff, people questioning my sexuality, questioning my sanity. And people even here at the paper and elsewhere have said, well, how can you let so-and-so read a letter that calls you a low-riding piece of vermin and then kind of not give it back to them? My theory is really that, you know, we control the microphone here, and that it's really not fair to take someone else's work, someone who's written in good faith, and I suppose you could say they've written in bad faith, but animated by bad faith, they've written us a letter here at the Globe, and we've used it on the podcast, and even by using it, we're in a sense making fun of them. But I don't feel that it's an occasion for me to showboat and sort of say, you know, ha ha, you misspelled a few words in your letter, or, you know, you're illiterate, you're from Prince Edward Island. You'll understand that in a few minutes. That's just not right, you know. You know, we sell papers, we charge a certain amount of money, and we're happy to have our paying customers. These are paying customers who maybe on a given day don't like something I've put on the paper, but that has no relationship to the fact that practically all of them have paid to read the Boston Globe, and there's probably parts of the Boston Globe that they're writing love letters to. So that's why we have the hate mail, and that's why we treat our hate mailers with love. So on May 23rd, I wrote a column called I Know What I Won't Be Doing This Summer, which was more or less this sort of cry of the heart about all this rubbish that we were being told to do this summer. We were being told to see the sequel to Shrek. We were being told to see the sequel to Die Hard. So I wrote down a list of things that I absolutely wouldn't be doing. And really, just as a throwaway to fill out the column, I mentioned that I wouldn't be visiting Prince Edward Island. I had been sent a press release by Delta Airlines saying that they were starting up a direct airplane service between Boston and Charlottetown. And I've actually been to Prince Edward Island, and I noticed that they had renamed or rebranded Prince Edward Island as the Gentle Island. And this is one really flat, boring place, of which the highlight of our 8-day visit was a trip to the Potato Museum, where we ate potato taffy and potato ice cream. But in any case, my very casual slur on Prince Edward Island created a minor furor in this faraway Canadian province. Here, for instance, is a letter from Joshua Russell Curley.
Dear Mr. Beam, what is your problem with Prince Edward Island? Honestly, I live on Prince Edward Island and spent a year and a half in Boston. I tell you that I would choose PEI over Boston any day. Tell me, Mr. Beam, just how much time have you spent on PEI? A few weeks? I have never seen a Guardian article criticizing Boston. Why couldn't you extend the same courtesy to us?
Well, thank you, Mr. Curley. The Guardian is the daily newspaper of Prince Edward Island, which on its website front-paged my criticism of the province. I guess because there wasn't too much happening on PEI that day, just like every other day on PEI. Here's a somewhat briefer message from a man named Matt.
Hello, my name is Matt from PEI. You don't know anything about PEI. PEI is the best place in the summer. Come here and find out for yourself, asshole, and don't say shit about PEI if you haven't been here. This is the most beautiful island in the world.
Matt, thank you for your comments. We got to watch out for those seven letters that the Federal Communications Commission doesn't allow us to say here in the United States. You do have a beautiful island when the sun is shining on those 6 days a year. And you do, in fact, have a lovely beach that I mentioned in my piece called Cavendish Beach. If you could somehow visit Cavendish Beach without going to Prince Edward Island, that would be a best-case scenario. Here's yet another letter from a Prince Edward Island fan, Christine Doyle of Framingham.
Dear Mr. Beam, it is quite clear from your piece that you have not visited the island tip to tip, as they say. I challenge you to ride a bike from Sorest to East Point on Route 16. It is not flat. Cavendish Beach is only one of many pieces of heaven. We have been going to PEI for 10 years and have had so much to do, we actually have not visited the Potato Museum yet. My well-traveled daughter chose PEI for her wedding, even though we own a place on Cape Cod. Now that's a spot one would not want to visit in the summer with the traffic, crowds, etc., etc.
Well, thank you for the letter, Christine, and a long and happy marriage to your daughter who has shooed traffic-choked Cape Cod for the comparatively empty PEI. As long as we're on this subject, I should add that there are two other things besides Cavendish Beach and the Potato Museum that are supposedly worth doing in PEI. PEI has become a golf mecca of the Atlantic provinces and really of New England, you could say, by extension. Unfortunately, I hate golf, so that's out for me. And it's also, some listeners may know, it's the fictional site of Anne of Green Gables, the famous novel that every parent of every English-speaking girl and many Japanese-speaking girls has read. But I'm not the parent of a girl, so some of the greatest attractions of Prince Edward Islands are simply unavailable to me. Lastly, on the PEI front, we have this letter from Kathy Trainer.
Are you by chance gay? I just read your article in which you slammed PEI. What we lack the most and don't want are gay bars. There is not a single one on PEI. Even the gay community on PEI are secure enough in who they are that they do not need to stand out in a crowd. That is why I asked if you are gay, because I am sure if you are that you are used to a more dramatic gay presence. And on that note, I can see why you would find PEI boring. I read your entire article, and the whole time I pictured Pee Wee Herman narrating it. That's what it sounds like. So, Mr. Bean, and that is not a typo, please, by all means, do not come to PEI.
Well, too late, Kathy. I've already been there. No, I'm probably not gay. I think that's about as stern a commitment I can make to that question. And I don't look like Pee Wee Herman, although that's certainly why I choose to do podcasting rather than video casting, because you would see that, let's just say I have a great face for radio. On June 6th, I wrote a column about the online encyclopedia called Conservapedia, which is sort of like a bizarro world right-wing answer to Wikipedia, which is the widely known online sort of user-generated encyclopedia. The people who founded Conservapedia, and in fact it was one of the sons of the relatively prominent conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly, they deemed that Wikipedia was quote-unquote too liberal, I guess specifically because Wikipedia had an entry for evolution, which was just far too radical for the people who decided to come up with Conservapedia. So now, on the internet, it's not really user-generated at all, and actually it's sort of aimed at the Christian homeschooling crowd. And of course, there's no real entry there for evolution. It explains how the world was created in 7 days by God, and so on. Not that there's anything wrong with that. In any case, this reader named Harriet Schley took offense at a relatively brief comment I made characterizing and, I suppose, making fun of and belittling the kind of liberals who live on both sides of my own house. So here's Harriet Schley's letter.
Maybe you were feeling particularly dyspeptic yesterday, but I resent being lumped into a group of liberal intelligentsia who trade in their pickup trucks. We'll never trade in our 14-year-old truck till it dies in the driveway. Okay, I own a prissy little Japanese Prius, but if you don't, you're probably just jealous that I get 40 miles a gallon instead of the 10 or 12 that you'd get in your good old American car. And that last canard, that I wouldn't walk into a Walmart. Where do you think I got my Timex? So I belong to MoveOn.org and occasionally stray into Bloomingdale's, but I want you to know that we liberal intelligentsia are much more nuanced than you're giving us credit for.
Well, I apologize for stereotyping the liberal intelligentsia, and here I'm forced to reveal one of the really filthy secrets of my entire column writing experience, which is that I spend an awful lot of time heaping abuse and scorn on people who are exactly like myself. When I refer to liberals driving around in, quote, their prissy little Japanese Priuses, I'm more or less talking about me. I bought a Prius a few years ago. I do get to Walmart ever so often, but I'm probably as guilty of this collective Volvo think as any one of the millions of Massachusetts residents whom I'm constantly mocking in my column. On July 11th, I devoted an entire column bemoaning the forthcoming, although already half over at that point, summer of Diana, meaning that the summer of 2007 was going to be just an orgiastic reenactment, celebration to tribute of the questionable life of Diana, Princess of Wales, the only virgin in the British Isles, apparently, when she married Prince Charles in the early 1980s. I started this column on a particularly downbeat note, picking up the familiar trope involved with the Kennedy assassination, which is that practically every American alive in 1963 remembers where he or she was when John F. Kennedy was shot. And of course, I, like probably millions of people, remember where I was when I learned that Princess Diana had died in a car accident. In any case, the column came after Tina Brown's biography was already a number one bestseller on the New York Times list. It came after the poignant appearance of her sons on Matt Lauer's Today Show, after the impossibly rockin' cool Wembley concert in Britain, where Elton John did not perform, thank God, Candle in the Wind for the 88th billionth time, and where Prince Charles and his new wife, Camilla, were nowhere to be found. In any case, whenever you write about Diana, and I have written about her a fair amount, I've used the phrase, I'm a Charles man, repeatedly. I kind of like this stiff sexual uptightness embodied by Prince Charles. In any case, here's one of several hostile letters, this one from Jim McCarrick of Mattapan.
Dear sir, it's bad enough that you criticize the 10-year tributes to Princess Di, but do you also feel compelled to drag the Pope into your web of sarcasm? Pity not Pope Benedict for his book ratings. Pity you! Anybody who questions who Jesus Christ is deserves pity. I guess writers like yourself just won't let us Christians alone. There's often that little jab that finds its way into so many Globe stories. Through your poison pen of journalism, you and others can knock us down, but you'll never knock us out.
Onward Christian soldiers, Jim. I'm with you. I should explain that Jim McCarrick's letter is referring to yet another sort of drive-by slag I made, pointing out that Tina Brown's biography of Princess Diana had outsold Pope Benedict's so-called biography of Jesus Christ by a factor of about 100. But again, I should point out that even though I make fun of people who drive Priuses, I am a church-attending Christian. So thank you for the letter, Jim, but be rest assured, I'll be continuing to make fun of you and your ilk for as long as the Globe lets me. Here's yet another hostile letter from Lisa Stewart.
Dear Mr. Beam, I read your recent article on Princess Diana and wondered if it had any point. If you are truly concerned with the amount of media interest in the 10th anniversary of Diana's death, do you not think you just added to it with your article? I must also ask, so what if people want to remember Diana? Why would that be the least bit bothersome to you? Do you have the same position on those who flock to Graceland to remember Elvis Presley? Do James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, or John Wayne memorabilia get on your nerves also? Maybe it isn't Diana who is the problem here. Maybe it is a you problem instead.
Lisa, I'm drowning in you problems. Although from where I sit, I call them me problems. Anyway, thank you for your letter. I'm sure you put your finger right on the actual problem. July 16th, I wrote a column with the headline, Ban It Before It Multiplies. I actually had written this column months before and was just waiting for what we call a peg or an excuse to write it. And that excuse came when the Massachusetts legislature was making noises about our becoming the first state to ban trans fats in restaurant food. New York City had banned trans fats. And I had been keeping a a kind of secret list of oddball things that have been banned all over America, and I'd coined the not particularly euphonious term, the United States of Banerica, because I remember going back like a decade, they banned smoking in prison, and a friend of mine and I couldn't believe that of the three things you can do in prison, meaning watch TV, have sexual intercourse, probably with a member of the same sex, and smoke, why would they take away 33%, you know, of your pleasure? And then the bans have just gone on and on. Of course, slingshots are banned here. I had to raise three sons in Massachusetts without access to slingshots, without access to firecrackers. I was in Chicago the day they banned smoking on stage, which seemed kind of bizarre to me, how you could possibly stage Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf without smoking seemed extremely difficult. I live in Newton, Massachusetts, the first city in America to ban smoking in public places. This column just sort of went after everything in America and sort of made fun of all these bans, and it elicited a fairly sharp response from Paul Cully of Westford.
Dear Mr. Beam, you apparently have not experienced a near or actual accident resulting from a driver paying more attention to a cell phone conversation than driving. And why would you not applaud healthier food choices for our school children? I had to read to the end of your column to see that you agree with me, that we need a place where people can behave pretty much as they like without harming others. That place is the United States of America, and many of the bans about which you write help to ensure that we minimize the harm we do to others. Here's an idea for you to consider. How about a ban on columns that contradict themselves and ridicule strictures designed to prevent harming others? Now there's something worth banning before it multiplies.
Wait a minute, Paul. We can't ban incoherent columns that have internal contradictions in them. Every columnist here would be out of a job. Cut us some slack, Jack. On July 23rd, I did yet another summer set piece column. This was about a website called boycottliberalism.com, which I guess I thought was maybe the top 10 most absurd ideas for a website I had ever heard of. On boycottliberalism.com, every week posts some new outrage, you know, committed by the sort of the liberal media, Hollywood intelligentsia, and urges you to ban movies from Disney, not watch ABC. It's absolutely insane. Of course, it holds the Boston Globe in extremely low regard, but then again, it holds literally every newspaper and broadcast outlet in America in extremely low regard. It's a complete joke. And among other things, boycottliberalism.com is in the business of making predictions about what's going to happen in the future. And the webmaster there had predicted that Dax, from the first season of the show Punk'd, will become a big movie star. And this was a huge challenge for me because I had no idea who Dax was. I since have learned that Dax Shepard is the man's name. He's an actor. And as I told my readers, he hasn't actually become the big star that boycottliberalism.com predicted he would. That, in fact, he voiced a part in Robot Chicken, which I think is an animated production, and that he also appeared in an episode of the Naked Trucker and T-Bones show, which is on Comedy Central and you see advertised a lot if you watch reruns of The Daily Show. And then I cruelly summarized Dax Shepard's career by saying, quote, "Stardom remains an elusive goal, I fear." And now we're going to hear from Dax Shepard.
What is your motivation for taking a pot shot at me? I mean, why would you go out of your way to list the two things I did to support friends of mine and not the five studio movies I've done? Without a Paddle, Employee of the Month, Zathura, Idiocracy, and Let's Go to Prison were all big studio movies. To list two guest spots on two shitty TV shows as all I've done since Punk'd is very calculated and malicious, and I don't know why you would take the time to do that.
Dax, thank you for taking the time to write. I am not familiar with any of the, quote, big studio movies, unquote, that you mentioned, but I don't want to be a complete jerk. I've heard of Without a Paddle, and I've heard Idiocracy, in fact, is quite good. I'm not familiar with Let's Go to Prison. I think I've heard of Employee of the Month. In any case, I wish you nothing but fortune and a continuing upward slope on the curve of your career. In the context of these hate mail podcasts, there's a columnist and a radio talk show host down in Hartford named Colin McEnroe, who's become a friend of mine. He's extremely talented. He has a blog called To Wit, and he linked to our hate mail podcasts. He trademarked the term the meanest man in journalism, which is what he calls me on his talk show, and he claimed that me and a few drunken friends of mine were getting together and reading my hate mail. And he challenged the readers of his blog and later the listeners to his talk show. He said he challenged them to write a letter hostile enough so that they could get included in this hate mail podcast. And a man named Terrence McCarthy rose to that challenge, and we're including this letter from Terrence in our special summer edition podcast.
Dear Alexander Boston Bean, first off, I don't care what you think of my clever greeting. I know your name is Beam. But Boston Beam just doesn't work, so I changed it. By the way, you any relation to Jim? Second off, I disagree with everything you've written lately. I haven't read anything you've written lately, but if I did, I disagree with it. I know. I know what you're thinking, and hear what you're saying. As they say on the streets of Hartford, I hear you. P.S. You can have one of your gin-soaked lackeys read this and post it on your website. Dan Shaughnessy, or Bob Ryan, or Joyce Carol Oates, one of those lush Boston sports writers who works for the Globe. To wrap up, I hate your recent columns. Don't write no more, and that would be all right with me. Hatefully yours, Terrence McCarthy, a steady Colin McEnroe listener and a fan of WTIC, and not a big fan of Boston Globe, which is a liberal rag if there ever was one.
Terrence, you win. Second prize. Two trips to Hartford. To answer your direct question, I'm actually not related to the family of Jim Beam, though my father had always dreamed that we should be. He kept writing away to them for free miniatures, which they, in fact, never sent us. Anyway, thank you for not reading, and thank you for not listening to this podcast.